The failure of drug war is glaringly obvious to judges, cops, wardens, prosecutors, and millions more now calling for decriminalization, legalization, the end of prohibition. Let us investigate the Century of Lies.
Hello, and welcome to Century of Lies. I'm your host, Doug McVeigh. On this edition of Century, harm reduction and social development. The United Nations Second World Summit for Social Development takes place November 4th through 6th. A number of side events are scheduled to take place. One of those events in the pre-summit activities November 3rd was entitled Harm Reduction for Social Development, Strengthening Health, Workability, and Inclusion. On today's show, we're going to hear portions of that event. But first, the UN's Office of the High Commissioner for Human Rights has condemned U.S. missile strikes on vessels in the Caribbean and the Pacific, which have killed at least 64 people so far, as violations of international human rights law. Here's Ravina Shamdasani, chief spokesperson for the OHCHR, speaking at a news conference in Geneva on the 31st of October.
The UN High Commissioner for Human Rights, Volker Turk, has said that airstrikes by the United States of America on boats in the Caribbean and in the Pacific violate international human rights law. Over 60 people have reportedly been killed in a continuing series of attacks carried out by U.S. armed forces against boats in the Caribbean and the Pacific since early September, in circumstances that the UN Human Rights Chief says find no justification in international law. These attacks and their mounting human cost are unacceptable. The U.S. must halt such attacks and take all measures necessary to prevent the extrajudicial killing of people aboard these boats, whatever the criminal conduct alleged against them. The U.S. has argued that these actions are part of a necessary anti-drug and counterterrorism operation, and they amount to actions governed by international humanitarian law. But as has long been agreed among states, countering illicit trafficking of drugs across international borders is a law enforcement matter governed by the careful limits lethal force that are placed on lethal force under international human rights law. Under international human rights law, the intentional use of lethal force is only permissible as a last resort against individuals who pose an imminent threat to life. Based on the very sparse information provided publicly by the U.S. authorities, none of the individuals on the targeted boats appeared to pose an imminent threat to the lives of others or otherwise justified the use of lethal armed force against them under international law. The High Commissioner calls for prompt, independent, and transparent investigations into these attacks. While recognizing the challenges involved in combating drug trafficking, the High Commissioner urges the U.S. government to adhere to international law, including as set out in counter-narcotics treaties to which the U.S. is party. Turk calls on the authorities to maintain use of well-established law enforcement methods to respond to alleged illicit trafficking, including through lawfully intercepting boats and detaining suspects under the applicable rules of criminal law. The United States should investigate and, if necessary, prosecute and punish individuals accused of serious crimes in accordance with the fundamental rule of law principles of due process and fair trial, for which the U.S. has long stood.
Thank you very much, Ravina, for the important brief. Colleagues, over to you for questions. Yes, Nina, AFP.
Thank you, Ravina, for this. You're calling for the U.S. to avoid extrajudicial killings. Are you saying that the killings that have happened so far, would you characterize those as extrajudicial killings? Thank you.
Thanks, Nina. As I said, it is the international human rights law that is applicable in these situations. It is a law enforcement context. It is not a context of armed conflict where international humanitarian law would be applicable. So given that these strikes are taking place outside the context of an armed conflict and active hostilities, the use of force by the United States against boats and individuals allegedly involved in illicit drug trafficking is governed by international human rights norms and standards that are applicable to the use of force and firearms by law enforcement officials. Therefore, the intentional use of lethal force is only permissible as a measure of last resort against an individual representing an imminent threat to life. Otherwise, it would amount to a violation of the right of life and constitute extrajudicial killings.
Thank you very much. For the questions in the room. Okay, we have one online from Nick, New York Times. Nick.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my question. The administration, U.S. administration, has called this a non-international armed conflict. Can you just explain why it isn't so? And could you also perhaps go into a little bit into the legal liability of the authorities who have ordered these attacks? Thank you.
Thanks, Nick. So in order for a situation to amount to an armed conflict and for international humanitarian law to apply, you need to look at the facts of the situation and you need to analyze it in relation to the applicable law. These attacks, these strikes are taking place outside the context of an armed conflict and outside the context of active hostilities. So the applicable law is international human rights law in this context and not international humanitarian law. You speak about the response. I mean, we are urging prompt, independent, transparent investigations into these attacks. Where people are killed, a large number of people is killed across multiple strikes, it is crucial that these deaths are investigated transparently. And one of the key problems that we are facing is the lack of transparency. We don't know who these people are who were killed. We only have claims that are not backed up by evidence.
Thank you again. Okay, we have a question. Yes, Nina.
Sorry, just one other question. You're talking about independent investigations. Who are you, who do you think should carry out these investigations? Thank you.
So as we always say, the onus is on the state. It is the obligation and responsibility of the state concerned to carry out investigations. That has to be the first step. But these investigations have to be prompt, thorough, and transparent.
Again, online questions. I don't see any in the room. No. Well, I'm sorry. Now a couple of hands are popping up. So, Nick, maybe that's a follow-up. And then Jamie afterwards. Nick.
Yeah, please. I mean, I'd just like to press on this case of the legal liability. What, you're calling for investigation. Are you calling for prosecutions? And given that these have been ordered by the head of state and by the Pentagon chief, are these people who you think should be subject to some form of prosecution? Thank you.
So, Nick, as I said, there need to be first investigations. And again, these need to be transparent, prompt, effective, thorough investigations. The High Commissioner has also communicated his concerns directly to the administration, to the authorities on this. So we are raising our concerns. We're raising the alarm. We are putting out the legal analysis because some of these, these strikes are being justified by invoking international law. And we are making it clear that the applicable international law here is international human rights law. So we call for these investigations, and again, the onus is on the state to carry them out.
Thank you. Jamie, AP.
Thanks, Ravina. Hi. Could you, basically, you're condemning, I mean, it's a simple way to put it, you're condemning these strikes, and is this the first time we've heard this from any UN organization? Thanks.
Thanks, Jamie. Yes, to be clear, the High Commissioner is saying that these airstrikes by the U.S. on boats in the Caribbean and the Pacific violate international human rights law. On whether this is the first time, well, maybe I'll leave that to Rolando. There were questions posed at the noon briefing.
Jamie, I believe this could be, but I would need to make absolute certain that is the case. But I'll check and get back to you. I wouldn't want to... I believe it could very well be the first time, but we'll get back to you just to verify that. For the questions online or in the room, yes, go ahead, Nina. It's all right.
I just want, on the investigation, call for investigation, if the U.S., they're the ones carrying out the strikes, you're asking them to investigate themselves, basically, it sounds like. If they fail to do so, I mean, would you think an international investigation would be merited?
You know, that would be speculative at this point in time. There are many mechanisms that do exist in the national context to be able to conduct oversight and to push for further transparency, for investigations, for a halt to these killings, and eventually for accountability. So it would be premature for us to go beyond that at this point. Again, the onus, the responsibility, the obligation is on the state concerned to carry out investigations and to account for each of these killings.
That was Ravina Shandasani, chief spokesperson for the UN's Office of the High Commissioner for Human Rights, speaking at a news conference in Geneva on the 31st of October. According to the High Commissioner, airstrikes by the United States of America on boats in the Caribbean and the Pacific, allegedly linked to drug trafficking, violate international human rights law. You're listening to Century of Lies. I'm your host, Doug McVeigh. As I said at the top of the show, the United Nations Second World Summit for Social Development takes place November 4th through 6th. A number of side events are scheduled to take place. One of those events in the pre-summit activities November 3rd, hosted by Harm Reduction International and the Open Societies Foundation, was entitled Harm Reduction for Social Development, Strengthening Health, Workability, and Inclusion. Let's hear one of the speakers. Catherine Cook is the Acting Executive Director of Harm Reduction International.
Hi, everybody. I'm Kat from Harm Reduction International, and I'm going to talk about harm reduction and social development. We're here in the sidelines of the Second World Summit for Social Development, and within the summit, they're talking about three interlinked pillars: poverty eradication, full and productive employment, and decent work for all, and social inclusion, justice, and non-discrimination. So the summit comes at a time when we're off track with the SDGs. We've got rising inequality, exclusion, and health crisis that are all undermining our progress. We've got marginalized populations, including people who use drugs, remaining far left behind. Changes in the 2025 funding and political landscape further threaten their health and inclusion globally. So I'm really excited to be here today to discuss harm reduction as a crucial component of social development. And hoping that we're reaching outside our harm reduction bubble today, I wanted to include a quick overview of what harm reduction is. So we're looking at a set of policies, programs, and practices that minimize the negative health, social, and legal impacts of drug use and drug laws. And at its core, harm reduction is about keeping people alive and healthy, promoting positive change, meeting people where they're at, with empathy, compassion, and without judgment or fear of arrest. It's a practical human rights-based approach rooted in dignity and inclusion. And it really matters because it's effective in improving health and social outcomes, it's cost-effective and cost-saving, and it's an essential component of the right to health, endorsed by WHO, UNAIDS, and UNODC. When we talk about harm reduction interventions, we mean drug-related health services like opioid agonist therapy, needle and syringe programs, naloxone to prevent overdose, drug consumption rooms, drug checking, and HIV and hepatitis services, and importantly, peer support as part of that. We also mean support services, so access to housing, to healthcare, to social and legal aid. And we're also talking about advocacy because harm reduction is also trying to address the harms caused by drug laws and drug policies. So we're promoting health and rights, we're promoting law and policy reform, and we're supporting community leadership as a key part of that. So people who use drugs are often criminalized, marginalized, and stigmatized, and that leads to a disconnection from health and social support. It leads to poverty and homelessness. Harm reduction isn't just about health, it's about social inclusion and justice, as we've already heard from Marcella. And on the slide, I've got a few things that I think are important for social development and, you know, that harm reduction really kind of contributes to. So firstly, employment. So people who use drugs, I think it's important to say that they're part of many workforces, and sometimes they're openly using drugs and sometimes they're not. Harm reduction helps people to stabilize their lives and support access to housing and health, which is needed to sustain work. An HRI study in Nepal recently found that more than half of people receiving OAT from one clinic credited that treatment for supporting them to maintain their employment. Harm reduction also creates peer employment opportunities, involving people who use drugs in service provision and as advocates for better law and policies. Increasing access to work benefits obviously both the individual and society. Moving on to education, harm reduction helps people stay in education and complete studies. At a time when people might experiment with drugs, harm reduction interventions like drug checking, available in 26 countries in 2024, empowers people to make informed decisions about their drug use. For example, a UK project called The Loop found that 50% of people discard their drugs when they find that they don't match the expectation of what they are. So if they find that there's actually something different in the drug than they expect to be finding. And 25% people avoid buying from strangers even months after they've had that interaction with a drug checking service. And so it demonstrates real world impact on drug taking behavior and reduction in risks. And then moving on to reduced incarceration. So punitive drug laws cause human rights violations and mass incarceration. 34 countries have the death penalty for drug offences, so the real kind of far end of those punitive responses, and over 615 executions in the name of death penalty for drug offences happened in 2024. Globally, one in five prisoners is convicted of a drug offence. In practice, the war on drugs is a war on people, characterised by oppression and rights violations, and certain populations are disproportionately affected. Women, LGBTQI plus people, Indigenous people and migrants, for example. And just as an example of what can happen when a country decides to do something different, for example, in Portugal, we've seen the alternative that's possible. So after decriminalising personal possession in 2001 and scaling up health and harm reduction, overdose deaths and HIV rates fell dramatically. Social inclusion. So harm reduction strengthens communities, supporting people to stay healthy, in work, to be able to care for families and be part of the communities and to contribute economically. A great example of this in practice is drug consumption rooms, now available in 18 countries worldwide, and they play a key role in reducing overdose deaths and connecting people to health and social care. An evaluation of Insight in Vancouver, for example, in the first few years of it being open, reported a 35% decrease in overdose mortality. Community leadership is a really important one. It's central to harm reduction and the advocacy required for law and policy reform to ensure equitable access to healthcare and protect human rights. From South Africa to Nepal, India, Thailand, national networks of people who use drugs are at the forefront of advocacy for policy change and to ensure access to essential services for people who use drugs. And then I think the last two are kind of the most clear-cut and obvious ones that we all talk about quite a lot within the harm reduction sector. So providing linkages to wider care and support. We know that people who use drugs often face stigma in mainstream healthcare settings. So harm reduction services, often led by peer outreach, led by communities and including peer outreach workers, provide non-judgmental, compassionate support. And they're often the only point of care that people trust. And these services act as a lifeline, connecting individuals to healthcare and broader social support that they might need. And otherwise avoid. And then lastly, the prevention of health harms. So harm reduction has a vast evidence base from all over the world. Needle and syringe programs, opioid agonist therapy, they're UN-endorsed proven measures to prevent HIV and hepatitis C and bring other positive outcomes for people who use drugs. WHO recently urged countries to prioritize these services, even in this context of resources being reduced. And peer naloxone distribution available in 34 countries worldwide prevents overdose and saves lives. It's a very cost-effective approach. Harm reduction interventions create healthier and more productive communities and reduce healthcare costs. So this evidence shows that harm reduction directly advances the summit's pillars, poverty eradication, decent work and inclusion, and therefore should be used around the world to save lives and as part of social protection and employment strategies. But this is not what has happened so far. So it's important to say that despite all this strong evidence for harm reduction, only 1% of people who inject drugs have access to core harm reduction interventions. Since 2008, the Global State of Harm Reduction report has shown slow but steady progress. More countries are adopting harm reduction into policy and practice. And harm reduction is now emphasized in global commitments because it's effective, because it's cost effective and essential for achieving SDGs. However, harm reduction is chronically underfunded in low and middle income countries with a 94% funding gap. Most funding comes from donors, particularly the Global Fund, followed by the US via PEPFAR, which contributed 8% of donor investment in 2022. And obviously this year we've seen the dismantling of US aid, and that's had devastating consequences for harm reduction, including service closures, rising infection and preventable deaths. Each peer worker loss disconnects hundreds of people from trusted care. Countries with domestic funding have been more resilient this year, but too few countries have integrated harm reduction in their public health budgets. So this isn't just a funding crisis, it's a human rights crisis. While harm reduction is in crisis, governments continue to spend vast sums on punitive drug control. And it's really time now to be redirecting funding from this failed war on drugs towards strategies that are evidence-based and rooted in community health and justice. The money exists, but it's being misdirected. Punitive approaches do not reduce drug use and instead fuel harm and exclusion. So at this summit, we call on countries and partners to integrate harm reduction into national social protection and employment strategies, to take decisive action, to institutionalize harm reduction and build resilient domestically owned responses, to divest from punitive drug policies and invest in health and harm reduction. Governments that are already investing should be championing success, like the Colombian government has here today, and highlight the health, social, and economic benefits that they can achieve. They should share lessons on social contracting and community-led models in particular. They should fund community and civil society organizations, which are the backbone of harm reduction around the world. We still do need international donors. We do need a fully funded global fund. And crucially, we must work together to protect those that provide the evidence base for harm reduction and those that monitor and advocate for these approaches. Community-led and civil society organizations working at all levels to hold donors and governments to account are being squeezed. Now more than ever, it's important that they're protected and funded. We're already losing organizations that do essential work. Mechanisms like the Robert Carr Fund were set up to support this and must be prioritized, especially now. And we're at a danger point with a streamlined WHO and the threatened sunsetting of UNAIDS joint program. These pose great risks to the future of harm reduction, and governments must protect what has been built over decades and not let it crumble at this critical point. In conclusion, harm reduction saves lives, but it also challenges stigma, rebuilds a social contract, and promotes solidarity. It directly advances the summit's pillars of poverty eradication, access to work, and social justice. Harm reduction accelerates social development and social inclusion. And that is why it should be embedded within national social protection strategies and global development agendas, ensuring those that are often left behind are not only protected, but actively included in the pursuit of sustainable development.
That was Catherine Cook, Acting Executive Director of Harm Reduction International, speaking on a panel entitled Harm Reduction for Social Development, Strengthening Health, Workability, and Inclusion, which was held November 3rd as a side event at the UN's Second World Summit for Social Development. You're listening to Century of Lies. I'm your host, Doug McVeigh. Now for some updates to a couple of Ohio stories we've been reporting on recently. First, in the Ohio legislature, Senate Bill 56 makes changes to that state's adult use and medical marijuana laws, as well as its laws on intoxicating hemp-derived products. The Senate passed SB 56 back in February this year. The House passed its version of SB 56 on October 22nd, but that language was much different than the one the Senate had approved, so the bill was sent back to the Senate to either accept or reject the House's changes. On October 29th, the Ohio Senate just said no. From the floor of the Ohio Senate on October 29th, this segment starts with Ohio State Senator Shane Wilkin, a Republican. He's followed by Senator William DeMora, a Democrat.
I rise to urge non-concurrence on House Bill 56. And just a few things I want to point out. Senate Bill 56 passed from the House, they failed to close the loophole for synthetic THC. Additionally, this would allow for the continued sale of untested, unregulated, which means packages that are designed and directed toward kids. They are not childproof. And as written, this bill would allow these sales to continue for an additional 300 days from the bill's passage. The bill would also allow for an enormous amount of hemp dispensaries to be placed around the state with no restrictions on how close they could be to a marijuana dispensary, only restrictions on how they could be or how close they could be to each other. This would also not allow the local municipalities to put a ban on hemp dispensaries as they did for marijuana dispensaries. Additionally, there would be grandfathering of those currently selling these unregulated, untested products, along with a reduced license fee, or what I would refer to as a reward for bad behavior. Lastly, there are several changes to marijuana law, as well as drinkable hemp beverages that I believe need more vetting. And for just those reasons right there, I would urge a non-concurrence. Thank you, Mr. President.
Thank you, Senator Wilkin. The question is, shall the Senate concur in House amendments to substitute Senate Bill number 56? The chair recognizes Senator DeMora.
Thank you, Mr. President. I'm going to stand with my colleague, Senator Wilkin, and urge a non-concurrence on Senate Bill 56. As my colleague said, there's so much in this bill that has changed from what we passed here, a lot of it not for the better. As my colleague pointed out, they have not done anything about intoxicating hemp products for kids and children. It still can be sold at gas stations. And as my colleague said, the 300-day grace period, I think, is just unacceptable. The people of Ohio want us to do something about these products. The governor tried to do something and was stopped because he didn't do it the proper way. And it's up to us to make sure now that we can do something to end these things, to get them out of the hands of kids. So I want to join my colleague, Senator Wilkin, and urge a non-concurrence. Thank you, Mr. President.
That was Ohio State Senator William DeMora. He was preceded by Senator Shane Wilkin. They spoke on the floor of the Ohio Senate on October 29th, urging the Senate to reject the House's substitute version of SB 56, which they did by a vote of 32-0. So now SB 56 goes to a conference committee. At the time of this recording, that committee has not yet been set up, so we don't know what the House and Senate will agree to, nor whether they will be able to agree on anything at all. When there's more news, we'll bring it to you, so keep tuning in. And finally, as we reported back in October, WCSB, the freeform, student-run, independent community radio station at Cleveland State University, was taken over abruptly on October 3rd by IdeaStream Public Media, basically Cleveland's NPR affiliate. The move sparked outrage on campus and in the greater Cleveland community. The Cleveland City Council on October 20th unanimously approved an emergency resolution supporting the students and station volunteers. Let's hear a little of the audio from that meeting. Here's Cleveland City Councilor Chris Harsh.
This is a cultural institution. This is about who we are as an identity, as a city. And I just don't think that Dr. Laura Bloomberg and Kevin Martin understood that when they made this decision behind closed doors. However, the good news is that all agreements between two parties can be amended if both parties want to amend the agreement. And both Dr. Laura Bloomberg and Mr. Martin can come to the table and amend this to bring the students back into the agreement between IdeaStream and CSU. To that end, the WCSB annual Halloween ball will be this Saturday, October 25th at the Beachland. It is free. Everybody can come by if you haven't had a chance to hang out and meet some of these young folks and some of the older folks and learn why this is such a beloved community. The WCSB community is built to last. They're here to stay. And Dr. Bloomberg and Martin should come to the table and talk to us. Thank you.
Thank you.
That was Cleveland City Council member Chris Harsh speaking before the City Council on October 20th. The City Council at that meeting approved unanimously a resolution supporting the students and station volunteers at the former WCSB. You can find out more about efforts to restore WCSB at the website xcsb.org. That's xcsb.org. And for now, that's it. Thank you for joining us. This has been Century of Lies. I've been your host, Doug McVeigh. Century of Lies is a volunteer production for community radio and syndicated via the Pacifica Foundation Radio Network's audio port service. We'll be back in a week with 30 more minutes of news and information about drug policy and the failed war on drugs. For now, this is Doug McVeigh saying so long.
For the Drug Truth Network, this is Doug McVeigh asking you to examine our policy of drug prohibition, the Century of Lies. Drug Truth Network programs archived at the James A. Baker III Institute for Public Policy.